This is Stories from General Conference, here on the Mormon Channel. The topic of this special episode is debt. This special collection edition features a classic conference address by President J. Reuben Clark on this topic, plus excerpts from more recent general authorities. For many years, church leaders have counseled us to avoid debt. During the 1930s, during the Great Depression in the United States, President J. Reuben Clark, then first counselor to Church President Heber J. Grant, gave an address in the April 1938 General Conference. His talk was in response to letters he had received asking for financial advice. Although it was specifically applicable to the situation at the time, it contains principles that still pertain to us today. We begin this special episode with an original transcription disc recording of the address given by President J. Reuben Clark on April 6, 1938.
I trust I may be permitted to refer to my observations of the last April conference and to reaffirm what I then said in the language in which I then said it. I made then and I make now no prediction. I merely gave by way of admonition the benefit of what many responsible men of affairs were then saying. Insofar as I am advised, these men have not changed their minds. In my own view, for what it may be worth, conditions appear to me to be in no better way. After the conference, people wrote asking if they should sell this or that property which they held. They were told I had offered no trading or marketing advice, no advice about selling or buying, but warned against speculation, that is, gambling. Others wrote asking if they should run in debt for this or that purpose. To the latter, it was replied that the church had always counseled against running in debt, that this seemed still sound counsel, and that if it were ever wisely to be disregarded, it would be in connection with the buying of a home or a farm, or stocking a ranch, or for carrying on some line of business. The suggestion was added that even in such cases, the whole proposal should be carefully gone into, so as to make as sure as might be that the investment to be made would be profitable. I should like now to talk about that question of debt a little more. I shall say nothing new. Everybody knows the things I shall mention. My only excuse for making them is that sometimes some of us forget what should in wisdom be remembered. What I shall say will not so much concern businessmen who are supposed to know when and how to borrow. I am speaking to the great bulk of us who have little or no business training and experience, and perhaps not too much business ability. I belong with this bulk and have had a chastening experience in debt. It is a rule of our financial and economic life in all the world that interest is to be paid on borrowed money. May I say something about interest? Interest never sleeps, nor sickens, nor dies. It never goes to the hospital. It works on Sundays and holidays. It never takes a vacation. It never visits nor travels. It takes no pleasure. It is never laid off work, nor discharged from employment. It never works on reduced hours. It never has short crops nor droughts. It never pays taxes, it buys no food, it wears no clothes. It is unhoused and without home, and so has no repairs, no replacements, no shingling, plumbing, painting, or whitewashing. It has neither wife, children, father, mother, nor kinfolk to watch over and care for. It has no expense of living. It has neither weddings, nor births, nor deaths. It has no love, no sympathy. It is as hard and soulless as a granite cliff. Once in debt, interest is your companion every minute of the day and night. You cannot shun it or slip away from it. You cannot dismiss it. It yields neither to entreaties, demands, or orders. And whenever you get in its way or across its course or fail to meet its demands, it crushes you. So much for the interest we pay Whoever borrows should understand what interest is. It is with him, it is with him every minute of the day and night. As to running in debt to buy a farm, particularly for the greater part of the purchase price, or for any considerable loan on a farm, I should like to give you the following facts. During the recent depression, a great insurance company had to foreclose on farm property which had been mortgaged to it for some $65 million. The present actual value of these foreclosed lands, the presumed actual value of these foreclosed lands, was more than $100 million, which is approximately the value of all the farmlands of the state of Utah. The lands foreclosed were among the richest farming lands in this country. After the company acquired the lands, it wrote them down about 10% of the estimated actual value, so that they now stand on the books at about $55 million. The net profit for the last year on all these lands taken together was 3.03% on the written down value of $55 million. This would be equal to about 1 6/10% on the full value as of the date of the mortgage. The very large amount involved in the location of the farms would seem to indicate that this is a fair example of the returns on the better farmlands of this country. May I suggest to you farmers and would-be farmers that you can hardly hope to borrow money, relatively large sums of money, at 5% or 3% or even 2%, and then pay out principal and interest in an enterprise that will net you only 1 6/10%. This is the simplest mathematics. Let me say in passing that it seems to me the worst curse the farmer has ever had, worse than pests or droughts or frosts or even poor markets, is the easy money which has been thrown in his path. What the farmer needs is not easy money, but good, profitable markets. These same principles hold good in all enterprises of all kinds. I should like to also to say something about long-time debts, say 20 or 30 years, for remodeling and refurnishing homes. I am not unfamiliar with the stock arguments and reasoning used to support this kind of borrowing. But we must fully consider this. Any improvements, such as bathrooms, modern heating and refrigerating plants and the like, will in the course of 10 years probably be old, out of style, and largely obsolete. If the family is the ordinary one, they will, at the end of 10 years, clamor for new, up-to-date furnishing, for another and modern remodeling. When that time comes, the family will have to realize that it must go on paying principal and interest for another 10 or 20 years on the worn bathtub and basin, the stained and cracked kitchen sink, the smoky furnace, and all the rest. This assumes, of course, that we have been able to keep up our payments for the first 10 years and have not lost the whole property before that time, both what we put into it as well as the house itself. I say this notwithstanding that, in my view, no home is too good, no comfort too great, no luxury too rich for the very humblest family that can afford them. But for the least essential comforts and for all of the luxuries, let me urge you to pay as you go. I wish to add something on installment buying, that popular method of running in debt for things and paying for them while you wear them out. Installment buying is a twin brother of long-time loans for remodeling and furnishing. A part of any successful installment plan is a very high, usually hidden, rate of interest. I know that in speaking of this, I am treading on debatable ground. However, I feel something might wisely be said about it by way of caution. In 1929, it has been estimated that installment purchases amounted to $6.5 billion. Dr. Wilford L. White, chief of the marketing division of the Bureau of Foreign and Domestic Commerce of our government, is quoted as saying that, quote, installment contracts entered into during or immediately prior to 1929 contributed to the last depression, end quote. Statisticians say that in 1935 there were 3 6/10 billions of dollars of installment purchases. For 1936, the estimates run from 4.5 billions to 13.5 billions of dollars. For 1937, installment purchases have been estimated at better than 5 billions of dollars. The system has been defended as justifying itself, quote, by providing the luxuries of yesterday for families of limited income today, by allowing those families to purchase such goods by pledging part of their future earnings. Its value has been appraised by other statisticians in this language. It leads to overproduction of luxury goods, and like monetary inflation, leads to a condition which requires for its maintenance larger doses of the same stimulant, shown by its extension to articles which depreciate rapidly. A British economist affirms, it has done much harm in America. It has been drastically limited in many parts of Europe. It is the enemy of real thrift. It is most tempting to the least provident. To buy on the installment plan means to mortgage your future earnings. If through sickness or death or through loss of work, the earnings cease, the property bought is lost, together with what has been put into it. I venture one suggestion. Until times become more certain, the ordinary family will do well to purchase by installment only the actual necessaries of life, leaving the luxuries to be bought as they can be paid for when purchased. I can only mention here again by way of caution another contributing element of danger in our economic life, that is the seasonal crop or short-term financing, which unwisely base operations for future profits on borrowed money. If I might be pardoned, I should like to add another word about two closely related subjects which I have mentioned or referred to at almost every, if not every, conference since April 1933. I refer to the enormous expenditures of the people's money and to the ever-growing feeling and belief that a great group of the people can live off the public without working. I should like to say again that neither the state nor the federal government has any funds, except only such funds as it obtains from the people. Neither of them has anywhere a great pile of gold to which it can go for its money. You taxpayers must furnish it all, and every citizen is a taxpayer, whether either by direct or indirect taxation. Whenever governments borrow, they borrow from the taxpayer, who must pay back or repudiate. To pay back borrowings causes great hardship and burdening sacrifices. To repudiate brings economic and sometimes political chaos. Some of our own members seem to be thinking that the church, too, has a pile of gold. It has not. All the church has is the modern income it receives from investments it has made out of the savings from your past contributions and the tithing and donations which you faithful members, usually not the critics and fault finders, make for the support of the work. You've had a report as to how that money has been spent during the past year. I assure you there are no secret or hidden expenditures. All are recorded and all audited. The church does not have 1 cent to be spent by anyone for any purpose, except upon an accounting made after the expenditure is made under an authority given for the expenditure. May I say here, the church is not in debt. None of its property is mortgaged. None of its securities are pledged. Now as to the other point, the living of one large group without work or industry, without work on the industry and thrift and sacrifice of the rest of the people. I say again, this is virtual slavery for those who furnish the livelihood for the idlers. I know very well I shall be accused of being harsh, cruel, and unsympathetic. I am not, but I consider the welfare of the whole people as superior to the comfortable or luxurious idleness of the part. To this kind of expenditure belong those old age gratuities of doles, which, to salve somebody's conscience, are called pensions. I mention this matter because it is growing to such large proportions and because it will have such a far-reaching and destructive effect upon the character of the people, young as well as old. These old-age pensions, so-called, have neither of these elements. Where these gratuities are honestly due under the law, there is no legal objection to taking them. But I warn you who take them not to count too much upon them, for they cannot continue to be paid indefinitely. Furthermore, where these gratuities are obtained by falsifying the true condition, by hiding property, by deeding it away in order to qualify, or by using any device to hide or distort the real situation, this is downright dishonesty. I honor and respect old age. I'm old myself. I would not see it suffer from want or from disease that can be helped. It is entitled to every care, to every act of kindness, to every loving caress which a grateful community and a devoted family can give. I have every sympathy with age. I know the difficulties which age has in fitting into modern economic life. I've had many matured, outstanding men come to me in New York seeking work. Some have been discharged from jobs they had worked up to during a long life of service. The Depression has replaced them with young men who had more endurance and who would work for less money. In America, at least, the human wastage in the Depression was far greater than the human wastage of the World War. The old man out of work is one of the most pathetic, heart-tearing tragedies of today. Some plan must be devised that shall make certain that no aged person shall be cold or go hungry or unclad. But the prime responsibility for supporting an aged parent rests upon his family, not upon society. Ours is not a communistic or a socialistic state, where the people are mere vassals to be driven about as animals from one krell to another. We are free men. So, still with us, the family has its place and its responsibilities and duties, which are God-given. The family which refuses to keep its own is not meeting its duty. When an aged parent has no family, or when the family is itself without name, then society must, as a matter of merest humanity, come to the rescue. This is perfectly clear, but it is a far cry from this wise principle to saying that every person reaching a fixed age shall hereafter be kept by the state in idleness. Society owes to no man a life of idleness, no matter what his age. I have never seen one line in Holy Writ that calls for or even sanctions this. In the past, no free society has been able to support great groups in idleness and live free. I wish in closing to say a few words about our church welfare work. You have heard a detailed report about its work. It has been operating for 2 years only. Behind it is merely the purely voluntary contribution by church members, some 767,000 men, women, and children, and some others who have, out of a love for humanity, made also gratuitous contributions. Of this number of church members, more than 172,000 made cash voluntary gifts, in addition to their tithing and other contributions during 1937. This means as much as 60% of the adult membership of the church, both male and female, made cash contributions to this plan for relieving human want. This in itself is a great spiritual Christian achievement. During this year, out of these fast offerings and other church revenues, assistance has been given to some 44,000 persons. We have not fully met our problem, but this is only our second year. We feel we've made a good start. We've gained experience. We are conducting a church-wide budget operation based upon the reports of bishops as to their estimated needs for this year, so that notwithstanding the economic difficulties that overhang the nation, we may more nearly solve our full problem. The church has never said it was going to give employment to all unemployed church members. It was said it would do what it could to this end. It has done so. It has found employment for some 6,000 of its members, which may represent as many as 30,000 members of families. The church has never said it would try to take its members off governmental work projects. But the church has repeatedly urged every church member employed by the government to give an honest full day's work for a day's pay. There are certain elements in the general relief situation in this West region where the bulk of our members live, which are not always in mind. In the first place, at least half of the population in this area are not members of the church. A very large percentage of these non-members are engaged in industrial occupations which are particularly affected by the present economic decline. In the next place, for one reason or another, not now necessary to consider, it seems fairly clear that no small number of those classed as church members on governmental rolls are either not on the church rolls at all or have been wholly inactive for years, many of them since childhood. Too frequently, these persons show a fixed unwillingness to give up governmental aid for church relief. The basic element of the church program is work in exchange for relief. The first effort of the church has been consistently directed towards relieving the needs of the worthy members of the church whose prior activity calls for consideration from the whole church membership. But the church has not turned its back upon the others. It welcomes their return to activity. It will look out for them just as rapidly as they can be reached. So all in all, I wish to tender my heartfelt gratitude and my sincere congratulations to the Relief Society, every officer and woman of them, to the presiding bishopric, to the priesthood quorums, to the general committee, to the bishops of wards and presidents of stakes, to regular and auxiliary organizations of the church, stakes and wards, to our church periodicals, to every man and woman who has in any way helped in this great undertaking, and particularly to those hundreds who, somewhat careless of their duties in the past, have come forward in these critical times and taken on this new work, fighting as veterans against our common enemy, want. We welcome you, brothers and sisters. I know that to every man, woman, and child who has given from his abundance, or who has offered the widow's mite to help his less fortunate, suffering brother, there has come a peace and a joy that has carried into his heart more of unselfish love for his fellow men than any unlike thing he has ever done. They have realized the truth of the great principle announced by James. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this: to visit the fatherless and widows in their afflictions, and to keep himself unspotted before the world. After and above all, as was stated in the financial report, while the church welfare aims, of course, to help those in need, its real purpose is not merely to substitute church gratuities for others furnished by charitable or governmental agencies, but to rebuild the character of its members and to promote and to foster the patriotic, civic, and spiritual qualities of the people. Discoursing in the temple on the second day of the week of the atoning sacrifice, Jesus declared the fate of those who should stand on the left hand at the day of judgment. Then shall he say also unto them on the left hand, Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was an hunger, and ye gave me no meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me not in. Naked, and ye clothed me not. Sick, and in prison, and ye visited me not. Then shall they also answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee unhungered, or athirst, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister unto thee? Then shall he answer them, saying, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye did it not to one of the least of these, ye did it not to me. And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal. The resurrected Christ, breakfasting the seven disciples on the shores of the Sea of Tiberias, in the early morning saith unto Peter thrice, Peter, lovest thou me? Peter thrice replied, Yea, Lord, thou knowest I love thee. The Christ thrice commanded, Feed my sheep. In these two excerpts from the teachings of the Savior, we have, my brothers and sisters, the whole principle that lies behind our church welfare work plan. May the Lord give to each and every of us the spirit which we require in order to understand His ways, measurably to comprehend His wisdom, and measurably to unite us in one common effort, all to the building up of His kingdom here on earth. I ask in the name of Jesus, amen.
Over 50 years later, President Gordon B. Hinckley, then first counselor to Church President Howard W. Hunter, spoke of his personal memories of the Great Depression, the setting for President J. Reuben Clark's address just heard. The following excerpt from President Hinckley's address was delivered in the April 1992 General Conference.
The world at that time was on a reckless pursuit of riches. Then came Black Thursday of November 1929. I was 19 years of age, a student at the university. I saw the economy crumble. I saw men whom I knew lose everything as their creditors moved against them. I saw much of the trauma and the stress of the times. I thought then, and I have thought since, how so many people might have been saved pain and misery, suffering, embarrassment, and trouble had they listened to the counsel of a prophet concerning personal debt.
You are listening to a special collection edition of Stories from General Conference on the topic of debt, an exclusive here on the Mormon Channel. It seems human nature pulls us from good advice given by the leaders of the church over many years. Greed, self-indulgence, and selfishness prevail where thrift and practicality would serve us better. In the April 2009 General Conference, Elder Robert D. Hales echoed advice similar to President Hinckley's and added an illustration from his personal life.
Today I speak to all whose freedom to choose has been diminished by effects of ill-advised choices of the past. I speak specifically of choices that have led to excessive debt and addictions to food, drugs, pornography, and other patterns of thought and action that diminished one's sense of self-worth. All these excesses affect us individually and undermine our family relationships. Of course, some debt incurred for education, a modest home or a basic automobile may be necessary to provide for a family. Unfortunately, however, additional debt is incurred when we cannot control our wants and addictive impulses. And for both debt and addiction, the helpful solution is the same. We must turn to the Lord and follow His commandments. We must want more than anything else to change our lives so that we can break the cycle of debt and other uncontrolled wants. May I share with you two lessons in provident living that can help each of us. These lessons, along with many other important lessons of my life, were taught to me by my wife and my eternal companion. These lessons were learned at different times in our marriage, both on occasions when I wanted to buy her a special gift. The first lesson was learned when we were newly wedded and had very little money. I was in the Air Force, and we had missed Christmas together. I was on assignment overseas. When I got home, I saw a beautiful dress in a store window and suggested to my wife that if she liked it, we would buy it. Mary went into the dressing room of the store. After a moment, the sales clerk came out, rushed by me, returned the dress to its place in the store window. As we left the store, I said, "What happened?" And I asked Mary, and she replied, "It was a beautiful dress, but we can't afford it." Those words went straight to my heart. I have learned that the three most loving words are, "I love you," and the four most caring words for those we love are, "We can't afford it." The second lesson was learned several years later. When we were financially secure, our wedding anniversary was approaching, and I wanted to buy Mary a fancy coat to show my love and appreciation for her many happy years together with us. When I asked what she thought of the coat I had in mind, she replied with words that again penetrated my heart and mind. "Where would I wear it?" she sweetly said. At the time, she was a Ward Relief Society president, helping to minister to needy families. Then she taught me an unforgettable lesson. She looked me in the eyes and sweetly asked, "Are you buying this for me or for you?" In other words, she was asking, "Is the purpose of this gift to show your love for me, or to show me that you're a great provider, or to prove something to the world?" I pondered her question and realized I was thinking less about her and our family and more about me. After that, we had a serious, life-changing discussion about provident living, and both of us agreed that our money would be better spent in paying down our home mortgage and adding to our children's education fund. These two lessons are the essence of provident living. When faced with a choice to buy, consume, or engage in worldly things and activities, we all need to learn to say to one another, "We can't afford it, even though we want it," or "We can afford it, but we don't need it, and we really don't even want it."
President N. Eldon Tanner, a past member of the First Presidency, was known and well-respected for his financial prowess and practicality. In the October 1979 General Conference, President Tanner gave the following advice.
"I'm convinced that it is not the amount of money an individual earns that brings peace of mind, as much as it is having control of his money. Those who spend a little more than they earn are controlled by their circumstances. They're in bondage. Now, the key to spending less than we earn is simple. It is called discipline. Whether early in life or late, we must all eventually learn to discipline ourselves, our appetites, and our economic desires. How blessed is he who learns to spend less than he earns and puts something away for the rainy day. Let us learn from the sorrows of the past and avoid enslaving our time, energy, and general health to a gluttonous appetite to acquire increased material goods. I know of no situation where happiness and peace of mind have increased with the amassing of property beyond the reasonable wants and needs of the family. Perhaps parents should be more like the father of the college boy who wired home, "No mon, no fun, your son." Father wired back, "How sad, too bad, you're dead."
Perhaps the college boy could have better used his time in industrial and self-reliant pursuits. Animals are blessed with instincts that normally provide safety in times of need. In the April 1981 General Conference, Elder Mark E. Peterson, a past member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, drew the following analogy using a personal observation.
On the street in front of my house is a row of chestnut trees. In the spring, they are beautiful, all covered with gorgeous blossoms. As the summer moves on, I see nuts begin to form in their little green pods. In the autumn, the nuts drop to the ground. As they do, squirrels seem to appear from nowhere. They sit on the sidewalk, bite off the pods, and then run quickly away with each nut to store it for their winter's supply. They're wise little animals, and they're industrious. They're quite fearless, too, for no one on our street ever disturbs them. It is intensely interesting just to watch them work for their living the way they do. They do not allow the chestnuts to go to waste, not one of them. They know their lives must depend on them during the cold and unproductive winter months when nuts do not grow on trees. They don't depend on anyone else to gather those nuts for them either. They rely entirely upon themselves. The Lord gives them the harvest, but they must gather it in. They teach us a great lesson in self-reliance. It is a lesson that is applicable to human beings as well as to the creatures of nature.
Perhaps the college boy in the previous story by President Tanner could also have benefited by a family environment described by Elder M. Russell Ballard in the October 2005 General Conference.
Have a simple family economy where children have specific chores or household duties and receive praise or other reward commensurate to how well they do. Teach them the importance of avoiding debt and of earning, saving, and wisely spending money. Help them learn responsibility for their own temporal and spiritual self-reliance.
Elder Marvin J. Ashton, past member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, was known for his practical wisdom gained over a lifetime of experience. In the October 1981 General Conference, Elder Ashton offered the following advice about recognizing needs over wants and avoiding debt.
One of the most rewarding projects for the family and the individual is to avoid debt whenever it is possible. For many of us, credit is like a magic carpet on which we can fly to places we couldn't ordinarily get to. We ride free at first, but forget a little later we will have to pay for the magic carpet. The practice of thrift is not outdated. We must discipline ourselves to live within our income, even if it means going without or making do. A wise person can distinguish between basic needs and extravagant wants. Some find budgeting extremely painful, but I promise you it's never fatal.
The topic of debt must have remained on Elder Ashton's mind. In the April 1982 General Conference, only 6 months later, his address provided additional advice on avoiding debt.
Fortunately or unfortunately, the business climate is always good for those who have a deal to promote. In times of recession or depression, unwise debt is encouraged by promoters who would give us the opportunity to supplement our inadequate means. During periods of prosperity and plenty, some try to convince us that then is the time to borrow, speculate, and move up to higher levels of living by riding the waves of guaranteed prosperity on the morrow. How often do we hear, "I would have made it big if the economy had not slowed down"? History should have taught us all that there is enough risk and uncertainty in normal conservative investments to cause the cautious to rebel at the exorbitant returns offered by those who would have us bet on the come. More often than not, those who can least afford to go into debt to provide funds for scheming money managers are those hurt the most when the day of final accounting arrives. It is true, getting into debt is a tanglesome web.
You are listening to a special collection edition of Stories from General Conference on the topic of debt, an exclusive here on the Mormon Channel. Counsel about avoiding debt has come regularly from church leaders over many years. In the April 1981 General Conference, President Marion G. Romney, then serving as second counselor in the first presidency, issued the following warning regarding debt.
Today, individuals and governments seem to think that they can achieve economic prosperity in spite of a spendthrift mentality. They spend and spend, mortgage and mortgage, pile up debts and obligations, and thereby lose stability and lose security and lose independence.
In the April General Conference of 1986, Elder James E. Faust provided the following counsel.
Payment of obligations is a sacred trust. Most of us will never be rich, but we can feel greatly unburdened when we are debt-free. Extended economic dependence humiliates a man if he is strong and debilitates him if he is weak.
Elder Faust followed his own advice, as evidenced in the following remarks by President Gordon B. Hinckley, given over 12 years later, when Elder Faust was then known as President Faust, as a member of the First Presidency. These remarks were given by President Hinckley in the October 1998 General Conference.
We are carrying a message of self-reliance throughout the church. Self-reliance cannot obtain when there is serious debt hanging over a household. One has neither independence nor freedom from bondage when he is obligated to others. What a wonderful thing it is to be free of debt, to have a little money against a day of emergency put away where it can be retrieved when necessary. President Faust would not tell you this himself. Perhaps I can tell it, and he can take it out on me afterwards. He had a mortgage on his home, drawing 4% interest. Many people would have told him he was foolish to pay off that mortgage when it carried so low a rate of interest. But the first opportunity he had to acquire some means, he and his wife determined they would pay off their mortgage. He's been free of debt since that day. That's why he wears a smile on his face. And that's why he whistles while he works.
The dangers of debt and the advantages of avoiding it was explained by Elder L. Tom Perry during the General Conference of October 1995.
Avoid excessive debt. Necessary debt should be incurred only after careful, thoughtful prayer, and after obtaining the best possible advice. We need the discipline to stay well within our ability to pay. Wisely, we have been counseled to avoid debt as we would avoid the plague. It is so easy to allow consumer debt to get out of hand. If you do not have the discipline to control the use of credit cards, it's better not to have them. A well-managed family does not pay interest. It earns it. I was called into a wise boss's office one day early in my business career. He wanted to impress on me what it means in a definition of interest. I gave him a book definition. He says, No, that's not the one. Them's that understands it earns it. Them's that don't pays it.
Years later, in the General Conference of October 2008, Elder Perry repeated similar advice in the simple piece of counsel as follows.
One of the better ways to simplify our life is to follow the counsel we have so often received. Live within our income. Stay out of debt. Save for a rainy day.
Next, Elder Robert D. Hales of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles provides two brief pieces of advice. The first was given in April 2006 General Conference, using debt as an example of making bad choices.
For example, if we make choices that put us deeply in debt, we lose our agency to meet our wants and needs or to save for that inevitable rainy day.
In the April 2003 General Conference, Elder Hales provided a reminder and ended with a question each of us should consider.
The living prophets have counseled. They've counseled us time and again to put our lives in order, to eliminate debt, to store food and other essential items, to pay our tithing, to obtain appropriate education, and to live the commandments. Have we obeyed these essential instructions?
In the April 2004 General Conference, Elder Joseph B. Worthlin of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles provided some guidelines to assist in financial planning.
Remember this, debt is a form of bondage, it is a financial termite. When we make purchases on credit, they give us only an illusion of prosperity. We think we own things, but the reality is things own us. Some debts, such as for a modest home, expenses for education, perhaps for a needed first car and other things may be necessary, but never should we enter into financial bondage through consumer debt without carefully weighing the costs. All too often, a family's spending is governed more by their yearning than by their earning. They somehow believe that their life will be better if they surround themselves with an abundance of things. All too often, all they are left with is avoidable anxiety and distress. Those who use credit cards to overspend unwisely should consider eliminating them. It is much better that plastic credit card should perish than a family dwindle and perish in debt.
And finally, we conclude this special edition of Stories from General Conference on the topic of debt with two brief summary excerpts from President Thomas S. Monson. The first was given in the General Conference of April 2006.
The day of reckoning will come if we have continually lived beyond our means. I urge you to live within your means. One cannot spend more than he earns and remain solvent. I promise you that you will then be happier than you would be if you were constantly worrying about how to make the next payment on non-essential debt.
In the October 2008 General Conference, President Monson again urged members of the church with the following admonition.
We urge all Latter-day Saints to be prudent in their planning, to be conservative in their living, and to avoid excessive or unnecessary debt.
For many years, the leaders of the church have made clear their advice on avoiding debt. We hope this advice will help guide your personal lives and enrich your future. This has been a special collection edition of Stories from General Conference on the topic of debt. Thank you for listening to the Mormon Channel. For more information, go to radio.lds.org.